Welcome to the Science Podcast for May 3rd, 2013. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, examining the possibility of life on other planets as part of our special issue on exoplanets, and a look at geochemical relationships back here on Earth.
What many people don't realize is that probably 90% of the carbon on the planet is in the deep Earth, below the surface, in the mantle and in the core of the planet.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
What makes a planet hospitable to life? As exoplanets of all shapes, sizes, and composition come into focus, the answer to this question is getting fuzzier. I spoke with Sarah Seeger about why researchers are considering expanding the so-called habitable zone.
In the field of exoplanets, we really, really want to find a planet that is habitable and has signs of life on it via gases in the atmosphere. Right now, we can't look at atmospheres closely enough. We can't get enough data to see whether the planet is habitable or has signs of life on it. So instead, we use a proxy. We call it finding planets in the habitable zone of their host stars.
So let's start off with a basic definition of a habitable zone. What factors go into deciding whether or not a planet falls into the habitable zone?
We define the habitable zone as the region around a star where a planet can have surface temperatures consistent with liquid water.
And so being in the zone doesn't actually mean that a planet can be inhabited, right? There could be other barriers.
Right. If a planet is in the habitable zone of its host star, you're right. It's not necessarily habitable or even inhabited. But what it means is we sometimes like to call it potentially habitable. That is, we call Earth the Goldilocks planet. It's not too hot, it's not too cold, it's just right. We know that if Earth was way, way closer to the sun, it would definitely be way too hot. We know if Earth was extremely far away from the sun, it would definitely be way too cold. So the habitable zone is just a guide. It means that if a planet does fall in there, it could possibly be right for life.
One thing I noticed in your paper was there is a really big focus on water, whether or not liquid water would be available. Why is that so important for determining whether something is habitable?
Well, all life on Earth requires liquid water. And so we use liquid water as one of our requirements for life. Now, what's really interesting is that people have revisited the question, do we really need water? And have actually concluded that we may not really need water, but we need some kind of liquid, a liquid where molecules can react with each other and form new, more complicated molecules. But if you look closely at planetary systems and materials available for planets and ask which types of planets have liquid and what is that liquid, we do kind of still, fortunately or unfortunately, come back to water.
It just seems the most likely source of that solution for things to work around in.
Correct. It's the most likely source that is detectable and is abundant. So, for example, Titan has liquid ethane and methane lakes. Titan's extremely cold, and from an exoplanet perspective, it would be very hard to detect and study a planet so far from its host star.
So that takes us back to the habitable zone, which, can you describe a little bit more how that's a relationship between the size of the star and the kind of planet and the distance between the two?
Sure. Let's start with the size of the star. Bigger stars are more luminous and have higher energy output. So for a big star, the habitable zone is actually quite far from the star. For small stars, they have a lower luminosity output, less energy going out, and therefore the habitable zone is much closer to the star. So for example, for a small star called an M star, which by the way are the most common star in our galaxy, you could have a planet in the habitable zone, which is so close to the star that its year is only about 10 days.
Wow. So in light of the extreme diversity and number of exoplanets that we've now seen, what are some of the other important factors to consider for habitability? Should we revise any of the considerations that have been in place until now?
To understand what might change, we should first review what people have been considering for the habitable zone so far. And that is a planet with an atmosphere somewhat like Earth's atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Our own Earth's atmosphere is dominated by nitrogen gas. We have oxygen and water vapor and carbon dioxide that all play major roles. So we call it a nitrogen carbon dioxide, water vapor atmosphere. Those are what have been studied so far. But you know what we have found in exoplanets is that planets come in all masses, sizes, and orbits. It's unbelievable. Any number you could choose for planet mass and orbit practically exists. Mm-hmm. And so we're starting to think that their atmospheres also will show some huge range of diversity. because we aren't able to predict from first principles how massive an atmosphere will be or what exactly it will be made of. We think some planets will be massive or cold enough to retain hydrogen in their atmospheres. Here on Earth, we don't have hydrogen. Mm. You know how when a kid lets go of a balloon and you see it float away?
Yeah.
It's kind of related to why we don't have hydrogen and helium. They're just too light. Our planet can't hold on to them. But if we have a planet that can hold on to light gases, well, let me tell you that hydrogen is a very potent greenhouse gas, much more so than carbon dioxide if the pressures get high enough at the planet's surface. So people have written about planets with hydrogen atmospheres. The atmosphere would be like a greenhouse effect. You can think of it like a blanket helping the planet to retain heat at the surface. And those planets could be habitable much further away from their stars than a planet with an atmosphere like Earth's atmosphere.
In your review, you mention biosignature gases. Those are different than just the general makeup of the atmosphere. Could you talk about how those fit in?
Well, we have a sort of series of steps that we'd like to go through in the search for life on other worlds. And the first one is to find a pool of small planets. The second is to understand whether they're habitable or not. And the third one would be to try to find out if they're actually inhabited. That's a complicated process, and we don't necessarily have access to learn about every step. So one concept is that whether or not it's our last step or it's a step we just jump to, why not just look for biosignature gases? Mm-hmm. The end goal is to identify a habitable planet and to look for signs of life in the atmosphere via their spectral signatures.
So what would an example of a biosignature look like? What would that be?
Well, on our own Earth, our best biosignature gas is oxygen because our atmosphere has about 20% of oxygen by volume. But without plants and photosynthetic bacteria, we would basically have almost no oxygen in our atmosphere at all. So oxygen is a gas that doesn't belong. It's present in many orders of magnitude outside of thermochemical equilibrium. And so we're really looking for gases that don't belong.
The atmosphere has to be different than the expected values in order to say that there's a biosignature. But how do you know what the expected values are of an atmosphere that's not ours?
Right. That's a really great question. Well, that's where models and basic understanding of physics and chemistry comes in. Mm-hmm. Because in general, we know for chemical equilibrium which gases should be present. But you're certainly correct that we need to know what else could be coming out of the planet's surface mm-hmm. and things like that. Ultimately, we have to hope that there is life that is creating a gas that is very complicated or a gas that is really, truly many orders of magnitude higher than what we think is possible mm-hmm. just by basic geochemical and geophysical processes.
And so is that something that we can detect? Are these features of the atmosphere things that we can measure right now?
We can't measure them right now. Right now, we can and have studied up to about 36 exoplanet atmospheres, but those are big planets like Jupiter with hot, puffy atmospheres. Mm-hmm. Hoping that in the future we can. And in fact, there's an under-construction space telescope called the James Webb Space Telescope. In the past, it's been called the Next Generation Hubble Space Telescope, and it will work at infrared wavelengths. And we believe that in special cases, the James Webb Space Telescope will be able to see biosignature gases on other worlds.
Okay. Well, Sarah Seeger, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks, Sarah.
Sarah Seeger writes about the potential habitability of distant planets in a review for this week's special issue on exoplanets. Hey, podcast listeners. This week's show is sponsored by Audible, and there's a special deal being offered to our listeners. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag, you can get a free audiobook of your choice.
And if you're having difficulty deciding, I just got a great recommendation for Amy Stewart's Wicked Plants, the weed that killed Lincoln's mother and other botanical atrocities. She exposes the sinister side of common plants and explores the boundary between medicine and poison.
Botanical atrocities. I like it. I hope you get a chance to check out that book and more from Audible. And don't forget, you can get a free download just for signing up at audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag.
So far, scientists have uncovered over 800 exoplanets roaming the cosmos. But as Sarah Seeger said earlier, we're still searching for that Earth-like Goldilocks planet. But if none of the exoplanets we found are like Earth, then what are they like? News writer Lizzie Wade chatted with me about the weird and wacky exoplanets we've spotted over the last 20 years.
For centuries, humans have imagined that there might be other planets out there that we can't see, but only in the last two decades or so have we been able to find them. We saw our first exoplanets in the 90s, and in the last few years, the field has really exploded with new missions by NASA and other space agencies, and we're seeing exoplanets that we never even imagined would be out there.
And of course, the ultimate goal is to find planets just like ours.
Yes, that's the holy grail. They call exo-Earths, Earth 2.0, Earth Analog, Twin Earth. These are all names that astronomers use, or astrobiologists really use, for, you know, this kind of planet that we would love to see that's in the habitable zone of its star. The star looks a lot like our sun, so it's not too hot, not too cold. Goldilocks planets, called sometimes, they're just right for the kind of life we know on Earth. That doesn't mean that they're the only kinds of planets that could support any kind of life out
right
there.
And so how many exoplanets have we found so far?
We have found a little over 850 confirmed exoplanets so far. And there are almost 3,000 candidate exoplanets, so those are ones that the data still needs some more analysis. But in terms of planets that we know about, there are in the mid-800s right now.
And how many of these do we believe are in the habitable zones of their stars?
Probably in the dozens. It's a little bit hard to tell when we look at things from so far away. Most of the planets we've discovered up until this point are what's called hot Jupiters, which are gas giants about the size of Jupiter in our solar system, with a pretty big range on either side. So the smallest hot Jupiters would be about 50 Earth masses. And they're hot because they are orbiting very, very close to their stars, which for the methods that we use to see exoplanets right now, those are the easiest kinds to see. So we have seen, you know, several hundred hot Jupiters so far. That doesn't mean that there are more hot Jupiters in the universe than any other kind of planets. It just happens to be what's easiest for us to find right now.
And the reason that we've found so few inhabitable planets is that our tools and technologies are just only spotting bigger planets.
Yes. And we have a lot of new different kinds of missions and different kinds of techniques that are going to start, you know, directly imaging these planets in the next few years, which will give us a lot more flexibility in terms of what kinds of planets we can see and what kinds of analysis we can do on them, you know, seeing what their atmosphere is like, if there's electric light coming off of them, anything like that. Those are all things that we can't really do right now, but hopefully we'll be able to do within the next few years.
Right. And as you said earlier, there are so many more kinds of planets than we ever really could have imagined before. So let's talk about these other kinds of varieties that aren't just Earth-like or Jupiter-like. So first off, what do you think are some of the nastiest, most inhospitable exoplanets that we've found so far?
The nastiest place to live would probably be pulsar planets. Actually, the first exoplanets we ever observed back in the 90s were pulsar planets, and these are planets that are orbiting pulsars. And pulsars are what's left over after a supernova. It's unclear, you know, whether they were planets around a star that went supernova and somehow managed to hang on through the explosion, or whether or not these things are just pieces of rock that have been pulled into orbit around the pulsar
right
after the explosion happened. Either is possible, although it's not very likely that planets would have survived a supernova, but it's not entirely impossible.
And a pulsar is also a neutron star. I mean, does that actually offer any light or heat?
No, but it offers a huge dose of radiation, so that's not going to be very pleasant to live on.
Right.
And we can pretty conclusively say that it's not habitable at all, these places. And I think another really unpleasant place to be would be a core planet. So core planets, they sort of resemble something like Mercury, the size of Mercury, maybe even smaller. So when you have a hot Jupiter or a gas giant orbiting very, very close to the star, sometimes the gravity of the star will suck the gas off of this planet and the planet will evaporate. And we actually have at least one planet that we can see right now is going through that process, we believe. So eventually all the gas will be sucked off. It's like if Jupiter was where Mercury is or closer, and the sun sucked away all of its gas, just leaving this tiny little rocky core behind. You know, first of all, they're going to be really hot because of where they are in relation to the star. And second of all, they won't be primed for life. They might even be sort of expanding and contracting from the gravity of the star. It just does not sound like good places to live.
Well, what about friendly places? You know, what sorts of planets might be a little bit more amenable to life?
I think just like in the solar system, actually, some of the best places for potentially finding life outside of our solar system might be moons. So we call them exomoons, or moons orbiting exoplanets. Like the moons orbiting Jupiter or Saturn, we think that some of them might have some key chemical elements that might be able to support life. The same could be true for exomoons orbiting gas giants and other solar systems. And the key here, I think, to both the life existing and for us being able to see them would be if these planets had some kind of tidal heating. So if they had something similar to Earth where they were radiating heat out from the inside, that would be important for supporting life. And it would make it much easier for us to see if they were emitting some kind of energy themselves, because these are very hard to find. And we haven't actually found any yet. What we have seen and are seeing more and more of are these circumbinary planets, which means a planet with two suns. So Tatooine is sort of the iconic example.
A fictional mm-hmm, planet.
Yes, that's fictional, unfortunately. Well, we think. And so this circumbinary planets means that they have two suns. So there are several different kinds of configurations that these things can fall in. The one planet can be orbiting both suns by itself. It can be orbiting one sun, and then that sun is orbiting another sun. There's all these different kinds of crazy dances that these stars and planets can get into. And we've seen systems with four stars interacting with each other, with planets also. And those are not any more or less habitable necessarily than any exoplanets in other systems. But, you know, it's quite possible that we could find a planet that's in the habitable zone of some of these systems. Although it's not just based on distance from the star. It's much more complicated to figure out what habitable actually means when you have a system like that.
Right. And then there are some planets that do, as far as we know, actually already have a lot of water on them.
Yeah, water worlds. So those are pretty diverse, and they're usually super Earth size. So they'll be like 10 times the mass of Earth. And some of them actually look more like Neptune. And so they'll have, you know, a very thick atmosphere of water vapor. And that often happens when you're very close to the star. It will evaporate, or it can be ice or oceans or water in some kind of weird physical form that we don't have on Earth. That's another possibility. But it's quite possible that if aliens were out there looking at our solar system and trying to figure out what kinds of planets we had, that they would see Earth and think that it was a water world. So, you know, it's quite possible that some water worlds have continents, that they could be Earth-like.
And then there are some planets that just go rogue.
Yeah, rogue planets, or lonely planets, orphan planets, wandering planets. These all mean the same thing. And these are planets that don't have a star.
I love that we anthropomorphize our planets.
I know, no, it's very poetic. And they just sort of wander through space all by themselves. And it's likely that they were somehow ejected from their solar systems, although we don't really know how they formed. But, you know, it's possible this could happen to Earth when the sun expands to become a red giant. The gravity could change, and instead of us just waiting around to get eaten, it could push us off into interstellar space where we would wander for all eternity.
So if a planet isn't close by, you know, a source of light, of heat, of radiation, do we think that life could ever be sustained on a rogue planet?
Probably not. It probably wouldn't form on a rogue planet. It's possible that if a rogue planet were ejected from its solar system and there were already life living on it that was intelligent enough, they would find a way to hang on. And, you know, like Earth has tidal heating, you know, there's some planets, it's possible that they could generate some sort of heat by themselves. But it's pretty unlikely. These are pretty lonely, uninhabitable places in general, I would say.
Well, I can only imagine the really awesome science fiction movies that could come out of all of our new knowledge about exoplanets.
Definitely. I also look forward to those.
Well, Lizzie Wade, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Lizzie Wade, Yadidjit Bhattacharjee, and Daniel Clary provide a gallery of exoplanets and planet hunters in this week's special issue. You can find the whole section featuring news, reviews, and a slideshow at www.sciencemag.org/special/exoplanets. We know a lot about the Earth's mantle. It's hot, it's solid, it's iron-rich. What we don't know is how its composition is influenced by the tectonic processes that cycle material from the surface to the mantle and back. Recently, two scientists discovered that they could track the mantle's geochemistry from mid-ocean ridge lavas, and that led them to uncover a surprising link between mantle oxidation state and surface processes. Lead author Elizabeth Cottrell stopped by and talked with me about the results of this new approach.
In this study, what we were looking at were lavas from volcanoes on the seafloor all around the globe, and we were measuring the oxidation state of iron, the amount of iron that had a 3-plus charge versus a 2-plus charge. And we wanted to know if that could tell us something about the history and the character and the nature of the mantle that melted to make those lavas. And when we looked at this, we found two things that were really exciting to us. The first was that the oxidation state of iron varies from place to place predictably as a function of the characteristics of the mantle source. And by that, I mean the geochemical fingerprint of the mantle. The other thing was that we see a correlation that's the opposite of what everyone had previously predicted, in a way that suggests that the oxidation state of iron might be related to the global carbon cycle.
So why were you interested in the geochemistry of the mantle? Why is that important in understanding the Earth?
The oxidation state of iron in the mantle, or the oxidation state of the mantle, is extremely important to us as humans and life on the surface because it determines, for example, the speciation of gases coming out of the mantle. You know, our atmosphere derives from melting of the mantle. And if the mantle of the Earth was much more reducing, for example, we might have volcanoes emitting carbon monoxide rather than carbon dioxide, or methane rather than water. So really, the oxidation state of the mantle is fundamental towards producing a habitable Earth at the most basic level. And then there's lots of other reasons specific to understanding Earth dynamics and the formation of rocks and the continents we live on that are important.
So primarily the samples that you studied in this were from mid-ocean ridge basalts. Why were those magmas in particular your window inside the mantle?
Mid-ocean ridges are a great place to study the mantle because it's a very simple tectonic setting. At a mid-ocean ridge, the crust is splitting apart, the plates are moving apart, and the mantle beneath is moving to the surface and melting as it does so. There isn't a thick crust that the melts are passing through on their way to their surface. The tectonic environment, the basics of the chemistry and how that melting works are fairly well understood. And so we can look for finer scale variations.
So tell me about the samples that you were working with.
They're volcanic glasses. And I'm really fortunate, actually, to be at the Smithsonian Institution, where we have a very large collection of seafloor glasses dredged by ships from around the world, all of the oceans, all of the ridges. And what we do is we take the volcanic glass and we polish it so it's very thin, perhaps 30 to 100 microns thick. That's about a few human hairs thick. And we pass X-ray radiation through the glass and take an absorption spectra, an energy appropriate for looking at the oxidation state of iron.
Okay, so you've got your samples, these glassy basalts. What exactly were the elements and the isotopes that you were looking for that would lead you to determine the oxidation state of the mantle?
Iron is a really abundant element in the Earth, and it's one of a few that has multiple valence states, multiple speciation, 2-plus, 3-plus, different charges it can have under the conditions of the Earth's upper mantle. There are a few elements like that. Iron is really abundant, though, and so it serves as a good probe of something called the oxygen fugacity of the system that melted. Oxygen fugacity is just a fancy way of saying the activity or how active oxygen is in the source. And then really the go-to thing for geochemists are isotopes. And that's because they record fractionation of elements in the distant past at the last major melting event. And so they trace reservoirs in the mantle. You know, the mantle's not a homogeneous place. Plates are being subducted back down into the mantle, and they carry the signature of the surface with them. They carry sediments from the surface. And so the signal of heterogeneity that you can really count on as a geochemist are isotopes, because there's no way to modify those with processes occurring at the time of melting. For example, the ratio of the isotope lead-208 to lead-204 correlates quite well with the oxidation state of iron, as does the ratio of strontium-87 to strontium-86.
So where exactly does carbon come in here?
That's a good question. For a long time, carbon didn't come in anywhere. I mean, we got these data. They were very enigmatic. The really surprising thing about these data are that the lavas become more reduced as the lavas become more enriched. And what I mean by that is enriched in highly incompatible elements. The whole periodic table is down in the mantle. Mm-hmm. You melt the rock, and some atoms are happy to stay in the crystals, and some just want to get into the melt. Kind of just like if you take a glass and you have salt water and you freeze it and you make ice cubes, it's going to change the salinity of the water that's left after you freeze out that mm-hmm. ice. Mantle works the same way. You melt it, and some atoms just hop into the liquid. These are highly incompatible elements, elements like barium and thorium and lanthanum. Well, these elements are enriched, are at higher concentrations in the glasses that are more reduced mm-hmm. than the glasses that are more oxidized. And this is the opposite of what many people had predicted. So we had to think about this for quite some time in order to make sense of it. There's two major clues. One is that the signature of this enrichment has some commonalities with carbonatites, carbonatitic melts, melting of the mantle in the presence of carbon. So there's a geochemical fingerprint there. And the second thing was that it presented a mechanism to generate the reduction. In the deep earth, carbon is neutrally speciated. Think of graphite in your pencil or diamond in a diamond ring. It's just carbon, just C. Mm-hmm. By the time a magma erupts on the sea floor, all the carbon in it is complexed with oxygen to make carbonate ions. And that oxygen had to come from somewhere. So as the mantle melts and as the mantle ascends towards the ridge, that carbon starts stealing oxygen from the iron and reducing its charge from 3+ to 2+. So with carbon, we both have the geochemical fingerprint and also a mechanism for creating this correlation, which is very strongly opposite to what had been predicted previously.
So what does this tell us exactly about the evolution of the mantle with regards to the carbon cycle?
Carbon is a really fascinating element in the Earth. We pay a lot of attention to it up on the surface here. It has implications for our climate, for life. But what many people don't realize is that probably 90% of the carbon on the planet is in the deep earth, below the surface, in the mantle and in the core of the planet. And that everything we're dealing with up here, the atmosphere, the ocean, the biosphere, is only about 10%. Hmm. So we have this enormous lever arm in the deep earth. And so much is unknown about it. We don't even know if the amount of carbon in the deep earth is increasing or decreasing, or at the surface, I guess, as well, as a function of time. What our study is telling us is that there are variations, it appears, in mantle carbon content, and that we might be able to use the oxidation state of iron to map carbon content, because mapping carbon itself by measuring carbon is very tricky, because carbon becomes a gas mm-hmm. during the process of magma ascent and eruption. And so most of these glasses have lost a lot of the carbon that they had at depth. So you can measure the glass for carbon, but you're not looking at the full amount. But the full amount that was there might have left its fingerprints on the oxidation state of iron. So this might be telling us about how carbon has entered the deep earth through subduction zones, the time periods at which it entered, and allow us to gain a map of it. And one of the interesting additional facts is that there's basically two locations on the planet where we think we do know something about the original amount of carbon in the mantle, one with high carbon and one with low carbon. And our low carbon samples are some of our most oxidized, and our high carbon sample is certainly one of the most reduced. And so this kind of corroborates the role of this intermingling of carbon concentration and the oxidation state of iron.
Elizabeth Cottrell, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure to be here.
Elizabeth Cottrell and co-author Catherine Kelly write about mantle heterogeneity and the carbon cycle online this week. You can read the report at www.scienceexpress.org.
Finally today, we have David Grimm, online news editor for Science. He's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. So, Dave, first we have a story about the first people of Australia. Where did they come from? How did they get there?
And how many were there? That's really been a big question. Some scientists have speculated that it was a very small, what they call founder population, maybe just a few hundred people, and that over the millennia, that population of Aborigines grew to more than a million. Today, it's about 500,000. This new study suggests that it was a much larger founding population, perhaps on the order of about 3,000 people that originally founded Australia.
And how long ago are we talking 3,000 people going to a new continent?
We're talking about 40 to 50,000 years ago. These people would have come from Southeast Asia, and the new date comes from looking at a number of artifacts from these Aboriginal people. The researchers looked at 5,000 cooking pits, human burials, shell heaps, charcoal deposits, any sort of evidence of very ancient human habitation. They dated these materials with radiocarbon dating, and they were able, with the radiocarbon dating, the amount of material that they were finding to sort of backdate a population.
That's kind of an unexpected method for determining population structure. A lot of people would think you'd go to the genes of the current population and look back. How did those kinds of results compare with this radiocarbon dating of artifacts?
So the genetic evidence was suggesting that this was a smaller founder population. But the advantage of the new method is it's not just looking at genes. It's actually looking at actual physical evidence of occupation. When you look at things like burial pits and cooking pits, you're really looking at things that would suggest what people were actually doing and how many people may have actually done it. Now, again, this is still an open debate because we really can't go back in time and figure out how many people were there. What's interesting about this new number, though, is if this 3,000 number is actually accurate, what it suggests is it wasn't just maybe a family that got lost in the sea, or maybe a few families that got lost in the sea and ended up in Australia. It really suggests that there was a purposeful migration to this continent. It could have been because of scarce resources in Southeast Asia or some other factors, but it really shed some light on the motivations of why people came to Australia in the first place.
We have maybe a motivation here, but what about the how? How did large-size populations like this get over to Australia?
Well, to do that, they'd really need some pretty big, powerful boats, and that's one sort of criticism of this study is that when Europeans first began to colonize Australia in the 18th century, what they saw with the Aborigines is that their boats were actually kind of flimsy. They were small, fragile rafts made of reeds or branches. That's not the kind of boat you would need to transport hundreds or thousands of people. It's possible that 50,000 years ago, these people actually had much more sophisticated watercraft and they became less sophisticated over time. But that's certainly one of the problems with assuming a very large founder population.
Really interesting. Next up, we have real life Pinky and the Brain.
Well, for anybody who remembers Animaniacs, the series in the 1990s, there's a couple characters named Pinky and the Brain. They were mice, and every episode they tried to take over the world. Well, one of the problems with mice, why we don't think they're as intelligent as us and why they probably won't be taking over the world anytime soon, is that their brains don't look like ours. It's not just a size issue. It's actually a structural issue. Our brains, specifically our cerebral cortex, this is the outermost layer of the brain. It's associated with high-level functions such as memory and decision-making. It's very folded in our brains. You can actually, if you even conjure an image of a brain, you sort of see those folds in your mind. The mouse brain, it doesn't really look like that. It's a much smoother structure. The advantage of the folds is it gives our brains a lot more surface area. That's a lot more processing power, if you will, to do a lot of higher-level functions, things like language and complex thought that mice aren't capable of, or at least we don't think they're capable of. And the question is, how do we get those folds in the first place?
Right. And how do we make mice smarter? Very important.
Well, that's the other question. In terms of the fold question, which is a little bit easier to answer, it has to do, at least according to this new study, it has to do with a gene called TRNP1. Researchers have found that when they mess with this gene in fetal mice, the mice brains start to look a lot more like human brains. They tend to have a lot more what are called cortical folds. Now, the researchers didn't test if the mice were actually any smarter,
okay,
but the brains actually look a lot more like TRs. When they looked in human brains, they found lower levels of this TRNP1 protein in areas that were destined to form folds versus in areas that did not form folds, which suggests that the presence of this protein actually inhibits folding. Counterintuitively, the less of this protein you have, the more cortical folding that you have.
So mice have the same gene that we have that makes our brain fold so much differently than theirs. What does this say about the difference between humans and mice?
Well, researchers have often thought that the reason that we are so much smarter than mice and other animals is because we have a whole bunch of genes that they don't have. Now, that may still be the case, but what this study shows is that it's not a question of having a gene or not having a gene. It's really the expression of that gene, how much protein that gene produces. And in this case, both us and mice have TRNP1. It's just that we're producing a lot less of the protein from this gene than mice are. That's making our brains more folded, and that's giving us an advantage over the non-pinky and the brain rodents out there.
Last up, we have a new way of treating the flu.
That's right, Sarah. So flus aren't just annoying. They can be very, very deadly. And researchers have been looking for ways not just to prevent flus from happening in the first place, but when somebody gets the flu or influenza, as scientists call it, what are some of the ways to prevent it from actually killing you?
We already do have a few flu drugs out there. Tamiflu is the one that most people are familiar with.
Right. There's also a drug called Relenza. And these drugs work okay. They block a surface protein on the influenza viruses, and that prevents them from leaving a cell after reproduction. They're pretty effective, but scientists have sort of questioned the safety of some of these drugs. You also ideally also want more than one way to combat the flu, especially if you're going to have something very deadly like the Spanish flu or the swine flu. So in this new study, researchers decide not to go after the virus, but to go after our own immune systems.
Are they trying to boost the immune system, or what kind of mechanism they're tackling?
It's actually the opposite. What they're trying to do is actually calm down the immune system. One of the reasons flu is thought to kill us is because it unleashes what's called a cytokine storm. This is a catastrophic overactivation of the immune system that leads to numerous inflammatory substances being released in the whole body. It can result in multiple organ failure. So the question is, can we not necessarily stop the flu, but stop the flu from overactivating our immune system, which eventually is what kills us.
So are they able to show that they could do this?
They did. They focused on a molecule called toll-like receptor 4, or TLR4. And TLR4 normally alerts the immune system to certain bacteria in the body, and it can be responsible for these cytokine storm-like events. So the question is, can we inhibit TLR4 and prevent the flu virus from overactivating our immune system? What's cool about focusing on TLR4 is there's already a drug in clinical trials that blocks TLR4. It's called eritiran, and it's been used to treat sepsis. And sepsis, kind of like flu, is a problem which results from an infection in the blood, which also causes the body to overreact and can lead to death. What the researchers found was when they blocked TLR4 in mice that had been infected with a lab strain of influenza, 90% of the untreated mice died compared to only 10% of those given the drug. This drug was given 2 days after infection. When they gave the drug 6 days after infection, 33% of the animals survived, which isn't great, but it's a whole lot better than every animal dying, and again, a lot better than the controls.
So this is, as you say, in clinical trials for sepsis. Is the next step to do clinical trials for flu?
That would be the case. They first want to test it in ferrets, which have been sort of a workhorse animal for testing flu therapies. And then ostensibly they would go on to humans if it was successful in ferrets. One of the cool things, again, about this drug is because it's already in clinical trials, there's already safety information being compiled on it, that may speed its transition to market, assuming it's as effective in humans as it is in mice.
Great. So, Dave, what else is on the site this week?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about researchers developing cameras that see a lot like insects do. Also a story about why sharks cannibalize each other in the womb. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about a pesticide ban in Europe. Also a story which has been generating a lot of attention about a congressional proposal in the United States to add an additional layer of oversight to NSF grants. This would potentially replace the peer review process with something like a congressional review. It's generating a lot of comments, as might be expected, from our readership and from the community.
And you can also find a related editorial in this week's Science by Kenneth Pruitt.
And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about, speaking of flu, the H7N9 bird flu. What are scientists learning about how dangerous it is and what can be done to prevent it? Next week's Science Live is about the search for exoplanets. What are we learning about worlds like ours outside of our solar system? So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for Science's online daily news site. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the May 3rd, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.